Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. It is bird news today. Mark Faraday off birding in Tanzania. Sitting in for him this month is Mike Tucker, naturalist and formerly with Rhode Island Audubon. Welcome, Mike. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Now, of course, it's not officially spring yet, but really starting to feel like it. Weather's getting, at least this week, a little bit warmer, and we're starting to hear a little more bird song.
It's definitely picking up. Yeah. This morning I was hearing the northern cardinals and tufted titmouse and morning doves.
You know? Yeah. So this is also the time that we're going to start to see a lot of action from the American woodcock.
Yes. Fascinating bird to talk about with behavior, that's for sure. Yeah, I've already had a couple of this year. Had one fly over the house last evening and heard their wing twitter that you hear in display. But yeah, they're fun. March is generally when we get the biggest push of them. They do breed around here, but we're fortunate enough to get a lot of them moving through the area throughout the month of March. And they like these open fields with early successional growth, grassy areas, those sort of things where they'll do their displays. You know, they tend to, just before sunset, start working their way towards the fields, and you'll hear some of their individual call notes, the peenting sounds that they make. Yeah. Yeah, there it is. Perfect.
Who let that one in here?
I like to pretend that was me doing it, but I can't do it that well. And yeah, so the males will eventually work their way out into a clearing. And, you know, just as it's just before it starts getting a little too difficult to see, it's usually when they'll take off. It's still a little light out, twilight time. And they just do this incredible courtship flight where they just do these large concentric circles around the edge of the field, climbing higher and higher, as much as 200 or more feet in the air. And as they're doing that, you constantly hear this twittering sound. And that twittering sound isn't a vocalization. It's actually the outer three primaries of the feathers making a vibration in their flight. Once they get to the top, then you start hearing this incredible, beautifully melodic chirping sound that they do at the top, almost like they're just singing up high in the sky. And then they start to work their way down and go silent. And they do this zigzag flight and quickly, very quickly, end up back on the ground right where the whole display started again.
Yeah. Look at me.
Yeah. He really tries to impress the ladies. But, you know, what I tell folks all the time, it's like, you know, the idea of courtship in general, as us humans know, it sounds very romantic. It's a beautiful thing to attract a lady, the beginning of a beautiful relationship usually. Not so much the case with woodcocks, though. You know, that sort of display is certainly to attract a female. And once copulation happens with the male and female, he's done.
I'm on my way.
He's on to more females. She's left to raise the babies, build the nest, feed the young, all by herself.
All the work done by the female woodcock. So if you're out and about walking around that time of night and you hear that little, that's when you want to really start to look around because you're probably going
to
see that.
Find a spot off to the edge of the field. And, you know, I've done this with groups before out on woodcock walks and stuff where you see where a woodcock will take off. If you got a small enough group and you're not going to bother it, you can actually move a little bit closer because you can count on it landing in the same spot.
Mm.
So sometimes you get an opportunity to get a really good look at it while it's up in the air doing its thing, singing like crazy. You just inch a little closer.
Just a little closer. You don't want to get right in that spot. You don't want to bother them. Yeah.
Definitely not.
And we should mention the 300 Committee in Falmouth has got three bird walks coming up specifically looking for the woodcock. Saturday, March 23rd and Sunday, March 24th. And then we have Sunday, March 31st. And that's the one you're going to be doing on the 31st. And we'll put a link up on our website with the details for those walks. And I am sure there are other ones happening around the Cape.
Definitely.
Wildlife Sanctuary out in Wellfleet, and so check out some of your Cape Cod Bird Club. Probably has information about those as well.
I would think so. Yeah.
And then of course we're all kind of keeping our eyes on the osprey nests this time of year because March is when we see the return of the osprey, and it always doesn't seem every year it gets a little maybe a day or two earlier than the year before.
Yeah. You never know. Generally by the third week of March, you can expect most of them to be back. You know, you might get a few filtering in early. And some of the earlier behavior that you'll see can be pretty dramatic. The male will often arrive first and he'll do this aerial flight high up over the nest site, high up over their territory. And a lot of times it's dropping its talons down. It'll be holding a branch. And, you know, basically claiming his stake to the territory. And, you know, they usually return. They have a very strong site fidelity to where they nest, and they come back to the same one and rebuild the nest every year add to it. They can get bigger and bigger.
I know there's some of them, as you're driving off Cape, you've probably seen that one that I don't even think you could see the birds anymore. It's so
really
big.
Deep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm surprised it's lasted with the winds and things we have around here.
I know it.
And that's another thing people shouldn't worry about too much. I know there's been a couple of nests that have pretty much blown right off. There's nothing. They'll build them back up again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, just around the corner here down near Nobska Beach, there was one that decided to build a nest right across the power lines, unfortunately. And one of the young ones wasn't so lucky. And but fortunately, Eversource did come by and they built an extended platform away from the pole. And they took down the old nest. So it's likely they will rebuild on the platform because it makes more sense. It'll be easier for them. So they definitely... rebuild if they have to.
And sometimes this time of year you get some false reports about return of osprey because there might be a gull hanging out in the nest or even a red-tailed hawk or something
like
that.
Yeah, great horned owl sometimes even.
and amazingly, these osprey, when they come back, they're not too shy about that is my nest and you are out.
Oh, yeah.
Eviction notice served.
Absolutely. Yeah, they can be, it's their home.
Yeah, exactly. 866-999-4626 is our number this morning. If you have bird comments, questions, stories for us, 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. It's kind of exciting as spring approaches. We've got the woodcock displays, we've got the osprey returning, and we're starting to hear the red-winged blackbirds. I guess we hear them because the red part isn't really quite red on their wing yet, right?
No, it is. It is now. Yeah. It's just that, when they start returning, you don't always see them because they tend to call within some of the areas.
Bushes.
Yeah, exactly. The phragmites and deep within some of the thickets. But they actually are already around. There's already a number of reports of them. They're not being territorial yet, but that'll happen soon. Their behavior is a little bit different than other birds where they have no problem having nests fairly close to each other. It's not like other birds where they kind of freak out if another one of the same species is nesting right next to them. Red-winged blackbirds have no issue with that.
A little more social?
Yeah, a little bit more social in that regard.
So a little bit of comings and goings now for March. Who else are we seeing returning?
Well, throughout the month of March, as we get a little further into it, we can expect to see the wood ducks arrive. Well, wood ducks will winter around, but they'll start showing up on their territory by the end of March. Of course, we mentioned the osprey, but piping plovers, usually by the third week of March. They're a very fun bird to watch when they arrive on territory with some of their interest in behavior as well. The male will do this great flight, flying over the beach, and it'll flap its wings a little bit differently and staking its claim to its territory, and usually arrives before the female as well. It happens with a few different species. Eastern Phoebe.
Oh, right.
Yeah, they're always fun. They're kind of very vocal when they arrive. There it is.
Katie's on it.
Right on cue. I love it. And what's kind of fun about them too is, of course, they'll nest in some areas where you just might not want them to nest, maybe underneath the eave of your shed door or something like that, you do your best to work around it, but they're great insect control.
Yeah, I was gonna say, and the house finches, they always like to come onto your porch and your wreaths or things that you have hanging around. I've had them even in potted plants.
Oh yeah, Carolina wren, another one.
Yeah, but
for that.
I love that because I can keep your eye, and then you watch those little babies get a little bit bigger, and then and if you're lucky enough to catch it when they leave the nest, it's so much fun to watch.
Oh, absolutely! It's great when you can have a yard that's dynamic and diverse enough to have activity like that. And I especially like that to help children engage in what's going on with birds in the natural world, because it's so easy to show them and to learn from that and get them involved.
All right. So last month we heard from a listener about a feminist bird club in Boston. We were kind of intrigued about that, and we reached out to a woman who started the club, Carla Noboa. She is joining us on the phone from her office in Boston. Welcome.
Hi.
So to be clear, you're not the founder of the Feminist Bird Club, but you did start the chapter in Boston. So tell us when you first heard about the Feminist Bird Club and why you were interested in starting one in Boston.
Sure. So I first heard about the Feminist Bird Club in 2017. At the time, I was living in Wisconsin, and I was just kind of getting interested in birding. It was something that I hadn't done too much of, but it was becoming more and more prevalent in my life. And I actually found it on Instagram. Someone had sent me a post of this cool thing called Feminist Bird Club. I thought it was really neat. And then when I moved to Boston, I was looking for a community to bird with, and I decided to reach out to Molly Adams, who started Feminist Bird Club, to ask her if people were doing it here in Boston. And she said no. And basically, I just asked her, well, could I start a chapter? And it kind of just spawned from there.
So what has been the response to the club in Boston?
There's been a huge response. I've been really, really surprised at how many people are interested in it. I don't do a ton of outreach for it, and I've gotten so many messages from folks that want to be involved, want to come to a walk. I'd say right now we have a mailing list of about 200 people. Mm. So it is quite large, and the average walk we get, I would say around 15 people is kind of the number that we've landed on. So it is quite popular.
So what are some of the goals of the club, and what role does feminism play in the mission of the club and its activities?
So the overall goal of the club is to increase diversity and accessibility in birding and the natural sciences. So that's kind of what me and Molly and the other chapters throughout the country are working towards. For me specifically in Boston, I try to make my walks always accessible by the T so that anyone could come, so that there's no barrier really. I try to make sure everyone knows it's an inclusive space. We frequently get people that have never really gone birding before who are interested in birds, but maybe don't feel comfortable going to a traditional birding group. So that's a big thing that I'm always working on, is just trying to get as many kind of new interested people in as possible so that I can kind of expose them to that and make sure that they feel comfortable.
So you're saying it's inclusive. So but are men reticent to join, or are you finding men and women both joining?
Men can absolutely join. Anyone is welcome. It is called Feminist Bird Club. Sometimes I do get messages from men that think they're not allowed to come because of that word, but that's not true at all. We actually do have a lot of men that do come, a lot of couples come. So anyone is welcome, really. We want everyone and anyone to come. The feminism piece really comes into play first in just conversations that we have when we're on bird walks. We do talk sometimes about feminist issues or policy issues. But we also do there's a whole fundraising piece. So every year, Molly works with a local artist or an artist somewhere to create a patch. And she sells that patch. Typically, it costs around, it's a small fee. Mm. And then that gets donated to a cause that we choose annually. So this year, we're donating the funds to the Indigenous Youth Activism Network and Pueblos Sin Fronteras, which is a group that's helping mobilize migrants. Hmm. So we try to pick an organization that's relevant or that needs support. I know the first patch, she donated the funds to the New York Abortion Access Fund. So we try to choose organizations that are really in need at the time.
So most of the chapters of the Feminist Bird Club are in urban areas. Why is that?
So one of the missions of the club is to, just help people see that there is access to wildlife and nature in urban areas. We have such large populations of people living in urban areas, and they often don't get that exposure to the outdoors that people in, more suburban or rural areas get. So for me specifically, it's very important for people to understand that they can still experience nature. They can still have those outdoor moments in a very high density urban area.
Yeah.
So that's kind of why I focus on that, so that people can find nature in amongst the skyscrapers.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I was just thinking of last year I was in New York City in late spring, and I was really amazed just walking in Central Park, the amount of birds that you can see in Central Park. So yeah, you just have to know where to look, I guess, when you're in a city.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're everywhere. That's another thing that I think is really important, is just kind of that mindfulness piece of an awareness piece of being in the moment and being present and seeing that you do find these things in basically anywhere. Like, you can walk out your front door and you'll probably see a bird, and there's insects and plants and everything, like even in these areas that are primarily full of concrete. So that's something that I think is really awesome about the club, is just helping people stay mindful and present and enjoy the space that they're in.
So do you have plans to leave the urban area, maybe come on some bird walks on the South Shore or the Cape and Islands?
Yeah, that's something that I would actually really like to do. I think if we can, you know, organize a carpool or something so that as many people as possible could come, it's something that I think would be really great. There are so many areas right outside of Boston that have such high bird diversity and such amazing spots to go birding. And I think being able to get people to those places would be my next goal to see if, like, so that would be like such a cool experience for someone that maybe doesn't ever leave the city.
Yeah.
What is the landscape look like in an area like that, you know?
And I would also suggest a whale watch, not so much to see the whales, but to see the seabirds. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually, the Boston Harbor Islands, they do a wildlife cruise every year in the winter. And I did tried to organize a group of us to go on that wildlife cruise. So there were a few Feminist Bird Club members who went, and we saw a lot of really great birds, including a snowy owl. It
was That's everybody's a favorite bird of the wintertime. Now, we have a very active birding community on the Cape and Islands. I'd like to think it's an inclusive one, but if there is interest to start a Feminist Bird Club chapter locally, what's your advice?
Well, I think, you know, just talking to your community, if you think that there's people that maybe don't feel comfortable birding or are interested in birding, I think just talk about it. I think anyone can be a member of Feminist Bird Club. You don't necessarily have to start a chapter to be a part of it. You can just get a group of people together that are passionate and interested and just go birding. You also, you know, reach out. You could more than welcome to reach out to me. I'm happy to have those conversations, happy to work with you. And then Molly in New York, you know, she does a lot of work with different chapters across the country. And we're always just, you know, hoping to get people interested in wildlife and nature and making them feel included and comfortable and that, you know, wildlife is accessible anywhere.
Yeah. We'll put links with more information about the Boston chapter of the Feminist Bird Club at our website, capeandislands.org. Carla Noboa, thanks so much for sharing that info with us. Appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
You bet. 866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comments, questions, or stories. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It is bird news. We have Mike Tucker sitting in for Mark Faraday this month, naturalist, formerly with Rhode Island Audubon. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Vincent is calling from Harwichport. Good morning, Vincent.
Good morning. How are you?
Great.
Good morning.
Good. Hi. A few months ago, when it was, of course, getting dark around 4:30 in the afternoon, I was driving in Brewster, and it was probably 5 o'clock. It was dark. Driving along, all of a sudden heard this thump in the driver's side window and drove down the road a bit. And I thought possibly it was a bird. I couldn't really see it when it hit. And I turned around and drove back. And sure enough, it was a screech owl that had hit the car. And I picked it up. And boy, did it feel soft and warm and just beautifully decorated, if you will. Its beak was still moving a bit, and I put it in the car, and I started to drive it to Wild Care, and the bird unfortunately died en route. Just wondering why the bird would have flown into the car, especially an owl with its great eyesight at nighttime.
Well, it's true. They do have great eyesight. But with screech owls, they kind of develop tunnel vision if they see some prey that they want. And what screech owls are known for is often hunting by street lights, sometimes a little ambient light filtering in from urban areas, suburbia. You know, they do very well. I mean, I was plowing a parking lot once with a tractor with lights on, noisy as anything. And here came a screech owl, came right down in front of the tractor and you know, just picked up a mouse that I stirred up. You know, so unfortunately, a lot of the roads are fairly lit and cars driving by and they pick up things. A lot of those, you know, marginal areas along the sides of roads are really good for rodents. And so it's a great place for them to hunt. But once they lock in on something, they really don't see anything else once they start going towards it. So yeah, it happens with screech owls quite a bit, unfortunately. I came across two this past winter myself.
Yeah, Vincent, thank you for sharing. So they are beautiful little birds, my gosh. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. I have an email. Let's see. This is from Diane. And she says, this birdhouse, she sent us a picture. This birdhouse is in my front yard and usually inhabited by chickadees. This cute little downy woodpecker now lives there. I'm wondering if it's unusual for a woodpecker to live in a birdhouse. Could you ask about it on the next Bird News?
No, it's not unusual. They're cavity nesters. And refuge I used to manage, there was a couple of boxes on the back edges of fields. I would get downy woodpeckers from time to time using them. You know, a tufted titmouse is another one. Nuthatches will use them as well as wrens, of course. But yeah, no, that's a fairly common occurrence for downy woodpeckers.
And Heather has a question. She says, I think I've seen two different kingfishers in this last week, one on a telephone wire near the cranberry bogs along the Coonamesset River, and also down in Woods Hole in some brush near one of the salt ponds near the bike path. Are they nesting now? My pressing question, I saw the one in the brush quite closely, and I know it was a belted kingfisher. It looks just like the one in the Audubon Field Guide. I saw the bird yesterday, which was March 6th, around 2 p.m. while I was out walking at lunch at eye level. But before I saw it, I heard it cry a couple of times, and I could have sworn it was a red-tailed hawk. In fact, I was looking for the hawk when I heard the cry and was so surprised to see that sound coming from the kingfisher. I've been searching for the call online, but all the other files I can find do not sound like the call I heard. Am I going nuts? Does the kingfisher sometimes sound like a red tail?
Well, I'll answer the first part of the question first. Kingfishers are not nesting yet. By the end of March, they're usually on territory. But what's interesting about kingfisher, they're one of the few birds that will actually form a winter territory and basically guard their food source. So if, and the Cape is an area where they will tend to winter over from time to time. But that's probably what you're seeing right now. But it's possible that it's not only its winter territory, but also its breeding territory. And as far as their calls go, no. Kingfishers, they don't have a call that sounds like a red-tailed hawk. So it's hard to say what was going on there. I hate to say never. Sometimes there's atypical things that happen, but certainly isn't likely that something like that occurred. I mean, there are other birds that can mimic red-tailed hawks, and certainly blue jay is one of them. And a lot of times you can tell because it's not quite as strong and with as the same sort of power behind it as the actual hawk when something like a blue jay will do it. But I've never heard of a kingfisher making that vocalization.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Excuse me, I have a little frog in my throat today. Yeah. thepoint@capeandislands.org is our email. A lot of folks feed the birds through the winter. I mean, some people do it year-round. There's some who say, well, in the wintertime, maybe they need a little help. And then, you know, into the spring. Do we need to adjust that as spring is approaching? You know, are we changing up what we're feeding? I'm thinking, you know, sometimes they're not going for the seed, especially once they start nesting. Maybe they're more into, like, insects, some of the birds. Maybe do we put out some mealyworms? Do we put out some jelly when the orioles come? About when do we start shifting what we're feeding and what should we be feeding?
Okay. No, that's a great question. Typically what I do is I will have the seed out throughout April, and I keep a close eye on what's going on. As you mentioned, once birds start nesting, chickadees and titmice and birds like that, nutritionally, insects provide more for their young. So once they start nesting, that seed consumption starts to drop down quite a bit. But because we can still see things like rose-breasted grosbeaks, you know, fun birds like that, indigo bunting showing up, you know, starting to show up in May, what I do I don't put out the feeders that have seeds sitting in a tube because it traps moisture and you get those warm days and you start getting a lot of mold and mildew that can build up if the seed isn't moving that much. So instead, I'll throw some seed out on a tray hanging where I had the tube feeder hanging instead. It doesn't get as moldy that way. It just sits out near the open. That way, if something like an indigo bunting or a rosebreast or grosbeak comes by, you know, there's going to be some seed there for it in May as well. But then once that passes by, I take those down and I start switching into other things. Hummingbird feeders, mm-hmm. I usually put up by mid-April. It's kind of on the earlier end, but it's fine to put
pays
it up.
Off.
Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes you'll get a Baltimore Oriole at your hummingbird feeder.
Yeah. They'll show up a little bit later. And for the Orioles, a lot of people are probably aware, you can slice oranges in half and just make a very crude feeder and put it on a spike and have them come right to it and feed out of it. And apples as well.
Grape jelly.
Grape jelly, yeah. Unfortunately, grape jelly also attracts a lot of ants.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm.
But the Orioles do love it, for sure. And, you know, other fruit, too. Some people put apples out mm-hmm. for the rose-breasted grosbeaks, and cappers and mockingbirds will go for stuff like that as well.
Yeah. What about, I'm thinking of, you know, I've mentioned this before, I've had to take down my fruit feeders because I attract rats. You know, I think that happens to a lot of people. And I had somebody yesterday say, what about putting some thistle up? And I was like, oh, because the rats really aren't so much attracted to thistle. So are there some things that we could do? I mean, my yard is, luckily I have a lot of things in my yard. I still attract most of the birds that, mm-hmm. that go to my feeder. I just have to search for them a little bit more than having them right outside my window. But I would love to be able to feed again.
Yeah, well, thistle is a great seed that you can keep out a little bit later than the other seeds because I mentioned how many birds will just kind of switch their diet and you'll start to see that seed consumption drop quite a bit. But if you have a lot of goldfinch around, they will continue to feed as long mm-hmm. as they'll let you know when they're done. But yeah. they'll often feed on thistle for quite a while, right through the spring. But as far as...
anything else? The rats are pretty much attracted to all the other seeds, right?
Yeah, for sure. You know, you mentioned that you have a yard that pretty much attracts birds anyway. And I think one of the key things to attracting birds year round is what you do with your yard, the layout of it, the mm-hmm. plants, the dynamics of it. And you want to consider, a lot of times people ask me, you know, what do I plant for birds, you know, that they're going to like? And it's all about diversity, really.
Mm-hmm.
So some people will say, oh, you know, winterberry is great for birds. Definitely plant those. True. But you want to consider plants that produce berries and seeds at various times throughout the year.
Right.
So if you have a nice composition of things like different viburnums like cranberry bush, or you might have junipers or cedars that produce berries, crab apples, things like that, they're all going to produce fruit at different times of year. But the other nice benefit of that is all these plants that produce fruit also flower. And mm-hmm. when they flower, they attract insects. And when you have insects, you're going to get other birds, insectivorous birds that aren't going to go to bird feeders. You know, so you've got a good chance of seeing warblers in migration and other ones that might nest around here, around your yard.
If you don't even have to leave home. You just sit out in your backyard with your binoculars. Well, and also, too, I think it's interesting, the brush. You need, I have the forsythia hedge, and then I have some Leyland cypress. And the birds are, they're crazy for that because they have some cover from the hawks.
Absolutely. That's an important component that I talk about quite a bit because you don't want to have this monoculture of grass just going right up to a tree or a shrub. It's nice to have that sort of successional growth. You know, even if it's, you know, unfortunately, some people kind of look down at the word weed. And there's a lot of plants that are actually beneficial that a lot of people consider weeds. I mean, goldenrod's a fantastic pollinator plant. And unfortunately, it gets a bad reputation as being one that causes allergies, but that's not true.
Not true, right.
Their pollen granules are too heavy. They don't go airborne like ragweed.
I think it's interesting they call it butterfly weed. It's one of my favorite flowers in my garden. I love that. And especially on the vineyard, you see it all over the place, that orange butterfly weed, which is so beautiful and not hard to grow at all. As a matter of fact, you'll have to pull some because you'll get more than you want. But one of the things I found interesting, too, is I used to, when I had more time, I would clean up my garden in the fall and then clean it again in the spring. I don't clean it in the fall
anymore.
Good
for you.
And I have noticed I have a lot more birds not cleaning up in the fall.
Oh, absolutely. A lot of the flowers like Echinacea, Rudbeckia, and some of these other flowers that just get these great seed heads.
I have all of those.
Yeah, you don't just leave them mm-hmm. be. And goldfinches and sparrows and a lot of the ground feeding birds
Junkos,
will be coming in
yeah.
there. Junkos, mm-hmm. for sure. And you know, so it's kind of having that sort of diversity is really what makes a bird, you know, habitat great. And, you know, yeah. you can really get a lot of different things the more plants you have.
And you mentioned trying to get kids interested in, and, you know, kids, they're naturally interested in nature. Mm-hmm. They like the rocks and the shells and the bugs and the birds. But I found it really interesting how many birds my grandson knows. I have no idea how he knows. You know, we'll be looking out in the backyard at the gardens and he'll be telling me what he sees. And a couple weeks ago, I said, "What are you looking at now?" He said, "A woodpecker." I said, "A woodpecker." I looked and it was a flicker. And I'm like, how does he even know that's, you know, it's a woodpecker?
Yeah.
You know, it's really interesting, but it's amazing how much they can soak in.
Oh, it's true. And there's so many opportunities now, too. I mean, there are children's birding clubs around and a lot of different organizations like the 300 Committee here in town mm-hmm. and Mass Audubon and other groups will do programs geared towards children. Mm-hmm. You know, there's going to be one I'll be doing here in town during the April school vacation that's geared towards children and young birders.
Yeah. I would also say museum in Brewster, why can't I think of it? The natural...
Oh, Cape Cod Museum of Natural History.
Thank you,
or something
yes.
like that.
Yeah. On the tip of my tongue. yes, that's a great place to bring the kids. You have the walking
yeah.
trail, they have the osprey nest, they have all kinds of great information in the building itself. That is another really valuable resource.
Well, one of the things I like most about birding, it's a way for people to be aware of the natural world around them, a way mm-hmm. for them to connect and maybe make some connections to issues going on in the environment mm-hmm. and to start children out and being aware of what's around them, I just think is a beautiful thing for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah. And it's really exciting. I know when I started birding, I didn't quite understand the excitement until you sort of discover something that's unusual in your own yard. And then it's like, oh my gosh, I feel like I discovered a new species,
yeah.
even though it's not. It's just something that's, you know, not in its where it normally is. And it's very exciting. And then also, we touched on this when we were talking to Kara about the seabirds. There are some absolutely beautiful seabirds that
oh,
are
yeah.
out and about, especially right now, I think, you know, the eiders,
sure.
mergansers. I mean, they're really quite lovely birds.
Oh, yeah. A lot of them are still here. I mean, you just take a drive along the coast, you're still going to see a lot of these common eiders piled mm-hmm. up in certain areas, and mm-hmm. they'll be heading out fairly soon. But
yeah.
Yeah, we live in a beautiful place here on Cape Cod okay. to witness and experience so many different
right.
species of waterfowl.
And it's worth sometime taking a drive down the other end of the Cape if you happen to be on this end. I think both ends of the Cape should go to the opposite
yes.
end and see what's happening. But, you know, Fort Hill is worth the drive. And, you know, if you want a little hiking out to the lighthouse at Race Point, you're not going to be disappointed. I mean, right now is a great time to kind of go out and see if there's any whales about. But if you don't see any whales, you're apt to see all kinds of great birds. And
oh,
it's
for
worth
sure.
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comment, questions, or stories. Maybe you have a great little birding spot that we haven't mentioned that you'd like to mention. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It is bird news. In for Mark Faraday this month is Mike Tucker, naturalist and formerly with Rhode Island Audubon. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. I have to tell you a story about 1 year I decided to experiment a little with my garden. I planted a gazillion sunflowers, and it happened to be just the right year for, I mean, these sunflowers went crazy.
Nice.
Granted, everything underneath it didn't do so well, but the sunflower, I could not believe the number of goldfinches I had. I must have had every goldfinch on Cape Cod.
That's great. It's so fun, though, watch work in a sunflower head.
Yeah, it was yeah. so much fun. I don't know that I would do it again, but it was a fun experience. So I guess don't be afraid to experiment, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and see what attracts. All right, so this is the time of year we're going to start seeing birds building nests. And when you find a nest, some do's and don'ts, I guess, if you find a nest in your yard.
Yeah, well, certainly give them their space. You know, I've seen some people that want to get a better view of the nest, and they might move some branches around to try to photograph it. That's a big don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they choose that spot for a reason, and it's all about protection, and you don't want to leave the nest vulnerable to predators. So certainly observing it from a distance, if you could get a nice look at it, great. But if not, then there's a reason for it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you kind of want to leave them be. When it comes to nest boxes, if you haven't done it already, it's probably a good idea to clean out the boxes that you have in your yard. And
what do you clean them with?
Oh, you just pull out the old stuff.
Just pull out the old stuff? Yeah. You don't have to, like, wash them.
It's possible a field mouse or something like that could have made a nest in mm-hmm. one, and you just want to pull out all the junk, put some gloves on, and pull it out, let them start fresh. Mm-hmm. And, you know, once something like a house wren shows up, they'll keep you busy with the boxes, because they do something a little unusual. You know, if you get a few nest boxes around the yard, before the female arrives, they'll start throwing a bunch of sticks in a nest, and then they'll throw them in another box, and they'll throw them in another box, and they'll fill up these boxes with sticks, and the female will be like, oh, all right, let's see, which one am I going to choose here? And he'll actually lead her to a nest to see if that one's suitable. Mm. He'll fly to another one, and once she chooses which nest she's going to nest
hunting.
In.
I love it.
Yeah, yeah. So sometimes a lot of people, it's a good idea to keep an eye on that, because you'll have a couple of boxes that aren't used that the male house wren filled up. So it's okay to clean those out at that mm-hmm. point, so something else can use it. You know, you don't want them hogging it all.
Yeah. So when you're thinking about placement of your houses, or even your feeders for that matter, what are some of the things you want to keep in mind for placement?
Okay. Well, with houses, you know, a lot of I try to put most of them up 5 feet or so I can easily access them, unless we're talking something like a screech owl box, mm-hmm. which I've had success in my yard. Those go up much higher. But as far as regular nest boxes, usually facing a clearing. Generally speaking, you don't want any branches crisscrossing right in front of the opening. You want to think like a bird. You know, if you're looking out the hole, you want a nice kind of clear view of what's in front of you. And that works well for most species. You know, something like a bluebird box in a field, on the edge of a field. You don't want anything right in front of it obstructing the mm-hmm. view. They want to feel safe when they look out of the box. And that sort of rule of thumb works well for chickadees and some other species as well.
When you're looking at the house boxes, the size of the hole will determine which bird you're going to get, right?
Yeah. I generally go with, I believe it's 1.25 inches that would be suitable for a bluebird. Mm-hmm. And but anything else will use that. So that's kind of like my standard go-to size for birds that a chickadee will use, a wren will use. A wren or a chickadee can use a smaller one, but they'll also use that one too. Mm-hmm. So that's the size.
And do you want to get have the little metal hole so that the squirrels, I've found sometimes when I just have a wooden box in my yard, the squirrels will chew a hole in that and make it bigger.
Yeah, I suppose that can help. I've never done that before. Mm. I've never really had a big issue with that.
You don't have the squirrels I have.
Well, I've had squirrel issues with some of the larger boxes, like American Kestrel and mm-hmm. screech owl boxes. And in those cases, on poles, I've put up predator guards and those sort of things, so they can't get up the tree or pole.
Man, what do we? I saw something recently, like you put a slinky on the pole.
Yeah.
And they can't climb up the slinky.
Yeah, I've never tried that, but I've seen video and it seems to work pretty well.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so the feeder placement, ideally you want to put it kind of close to where there's some cover, like some brush. I had mine when I was feeding my birds near my forsythia hedge, and I found that when the hedge was cut down, I didn't get as much activity as when the hedge is there.
Right. That's a good point. There's a lot to consider when placing your feeders someplace, and it has to do with the safety of the birds, and what you mentioned, the birds probably didn't feel safe. So you want the ground clear underneath feeders, because drop seed, you don't want to provide an opportunity for cats and other animals to pounce upon birds hiding mm-hmm. in bushes and that sort of thing. So a lot of times people will put feeders off the corner of a deck or something like that, and there's shrubs and bushes underneath it. That's mm-hmm. not necessarily ideal. And also you want to consider a safe distance from windows.
I was gonna say, the other thing too bad about the deck is the rats can live under your deck.
True. And you know a little something about that.
Didn't have them under my deck, but my neighbor did.
But, you know, window strikes can be a problem. And so a lot of times you don't want the feeder directly adjacent to a large pane of glass. There are things you can do, and you could find a lot of resources online to distract the birds from seeing that glare. But even if you just move the feeders a little bit, more at an angle where if they're at the feeder and they're taking off from the feeder for either shelter or just to go to a tree or work their way to their perch, you know, it's going to be more of an angle to the window. So it's not going to be like a, excuse me, a direct flight. Mm-hmm. So that can be important as well.
Okay. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to give us a bird comment question or maybe a suggestion, 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so some thoughts on why we feed the birds. I mean, we've had different opinions on this on the program. I think Michael Connor from the Birdwatchers General Store said, it's not that they really need us, it's because we want to see them. He says we feed them for ourselves.
Well, yeah, I think that's a big part of it. It's important to remember that a small percentage of the birds that we have in our area will actually go to feeders. But I like to look at it this way. We've done plenty to make life difficult for them. Mm. And the biggest limiting factor when it comes to bird populations is loss of habitat.
Right.
And I like to consider bird feeders more of a resource, like a fueling station, if you will. And some people blame the fact that there are a lot of bird feeders around for birds to tend to overwinter when they shouldn't. And that's not really the case. I blame more of the changing habitat for that. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a lot more edge habitat created through the fragmentation of forests. You know, you got power line right-of-ways, neighborhoods, all these things where you get all these invasive shrubs and even native shrubs that thrive in those areas. And that helps helps a lot of these birds carry on throughout the fall. And next thing you know, it's winter. And, you know, they've been feeding throughout that time. So when winter gets a little harsh and they have bird feeders to go to, that's not a bad thing.
Yeah. What about the change of habitat? And I think also, too, that, you know, climate change. We're seeing a lot of birds kind of creeping up into our region that we didn't see so much of any before, and some that we don't see much, like the bobwhites. We don't see those anymore.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's definitely a few things to talk about there. The habitat has changed quite a bit. You know, I've heard reports that over the last 40 or 50 years, grassland birds has declined as much as 75%. That is absolutely huge. And that's mostly due to loss of habitat. And a lot of the, you know, that's probably very relevant here on Cape Cod, where there used to be a lot of grassland areas and farmland. So birds like Savannah sparrow, bobwhite quail, eastern meadowlark, grasshopper sparrow, all these birds are in sharp decline. But there are some success stories as well within that. You know, a lot of conservation organizations will identify some suitable habitat and either work towards making it even better. And, you know, the crane wildlife.
I was just going to say, yeah, with the grassland, the grasshopper sparrow. I mean, they've done a lot of great stuff. Yeah.
Major success story there. This winter, I saw a number of meadowlarks there. A lot of large flocks of those flying around there. But it's, you know, The dynamic of bird populations has shifted and changed. And you mentioned a lot of these birds that are creeping north. Certainly climate change over time is going to make a large difference there. But I think the biggest reason we're seeing a lot of that change right now is more of habitat change. Mm-hmm. I there's a lot of prediction on what's going to happen over time with climate change. Excuse me. But the fact that these birds can... Now, birds like northern cardinal, for example, you know, that's a bird that has shifted north over the year. You know, going back 50 years ago, that was a fairly rare bird in the Northeast. Hmm. You know, Carolina wren, also more of a southern species that has worked its way northward. And orchard orioles, another one. So some of these birds are thriving in this fragmented habitat. You know, better chance of them to survive with the dynamic of what we're seeing in out there. It's a little bit different. Things are shifting. But on the same side, you know, a lot of people talk about how we're seeing more birds now. We're seeing a lot of these birds do so well. But there are also a number of birds in decline.
Yeah.
A lot of the deep forest nesting birds and the grassland ones like I'm talking about.
Yeah. Let's talk to Sandy, who's giving us a call from East Ham. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. Just to speak to the window strikes. I was noticing in my home, we live in a pond, and I was getting quite a few strikes in this one window of a bedroom. And then I realized that we have a large mirror that was on the other side, so that the birds, it seemed that the birds were seeing the reflection of the water. So what we do is we sort of cover up the mirror with a scarf, and the strikes were greatly declined. So that's just something that we figured out.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good job on your part to recognize that.
Detective work there.
Yeah, yeah. there are...
Think like a bird.
Yeah,
absolutely. They actually sell some film that you can put on the outside of your windows.
And it works. I've used that. It works very well. It's sort of like we don't see it, but it gives some kind of iridescent sort of glow or something that they see.
From the outside, one that I saw is it has this more opaque look to it without the glare.
Yep.
But from the inside, you could still see out perfectly fine.
Right.
And they say that actually helps with cooling costs in the summertime because it blocks a lot of that sunlight.
I didn't do the whole window. I just did pieces of the window. But Sandy, thanks for that. Thanks for that story. We appreciate that. Mary Ann has written, any hints about robin nest box placement? Last spring, a robin kept thumping against the windows, 12 pane. He worked his way all around the house, left footprints on some of them. So I built a box using the Cornell plans, open face, and put it on the side of the house near some bushes. Totally ignored it.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard to say what they're going to go for, but I've made basic platforms for robins, just a small piece of board with a little bracket underneath it and maybe a small lip around it, and up underneath the eaves has worked usually pretty well. Maybe drop down a couple of feet from the eaves of a house, and but you know, a lot of factors can come into play. Activity that might be near that box, whether it's people going in and out of a door, whether or not it's people pulling in and out of a driveway or just walking by quite a bit could come into play. But trying to find that place where it's just going to be happy and it's going to feel safe and there's not going to be much activity and the dimensions are right and everything else, you know, you might have some luck there.
Yeah. Once you find a good spot, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Water's also, I guess it'll be less so important as the ice starts to melt. But right now, it's still a good idea to keep those bird baths going, right? Because you may get some birds that would never come to a feeder.
Well, that's the nice part about bird baths and a heated bird bath in particular in the middle of winter is a bird magnet, I like to say. You never know what you're going to get. And even throughout the spring, it's really nice to see a lot of these birds that are showing up. You know, you can get beautiful migrant warblers popping down and taking a bath in the middle of spring. You never know what you're going to see. Like you say, it's just anything can use them. And some of my best yard birds I've ever had were birds that I've only seen in my bird bath. And it's always fun to add a new bird to your yard list, which is also a great family activity to do to kind of, you know, have a little bit of excitement on what that number's up to and trying to find that new bird for your list.
I haven't thought about the list. I might have to do that. Yeah,
yeah,
make the list. Yeah, the other danger for our little songbirds are cats. And now we always say, please keep the cats indoors. And, you know, I get so upset that I have two neighborhood cats who visit my yard because they know that's where the birds are. All I can do is chase them out of the yard.
Yeah, it's tough. I just try to educate and preach as much as I can about cats. But I'm a cat owner. I absolutely love cats. It's because I love cats, I wouldn't even consider letting my cats outside.
They won't get hit by a car and they won't get eaten by a coyote.
Yeah, they're more susceptible to disease. Mm-hmm. Numbers show that statistically, they don't live nearly as long as cats that are kept inside. But of course, their impact on wildlife is huge.
Yeah.
They certainly have a big impact on birds.
Certainly. All right, Mike Tucker, thanks so much for sitting in for Mark this month. We really appreciate having you here. It was fun.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.